Hello everyone. Thanks to the organizers for inviting me to this lovely place. So I'll tell you about both measurements of the expansion rate of the Crab Nebula, both in the radio and in the optical. I'll start with a pretty picture. These are new radio observations of the Crab that we got in 2012. Doesn't really look that much different than it does before. Now, the reason we observed the Crab was that recently the Crab has been showing these gamma ray flares, or sorry, the gamma ray flares were recently detected. It's probably been doing it for a long time, where the gamma ray emission from the Crab sort of jumps up by factors of several on short time scales. These are not yet well understood. The problem with gamma rays, of course, is that they're not very well localized. Resolution is on the order of a degree, so we have no idea where in the nebula this is happening because of the short time scales. We know it's in some small part of the nebula. So the idea was to go point the VLA at the Crab after a gamma ray flare and see if anything happened. Radio emission is often associated with gamma ray emission, so that seemed like not a bad idea. There had been earlier attempts to do this which hadn't detected anything, but we observed it about just 40 days or so after a flare in 2012 July. And what we did was we got two sets of VLA observations about a week apart, and this is the difference image between the two. So this is the things that changed over 6 days, and the idea was if there was radio emission associated with this flare, it would probably be changing relatively rapidly, and it should show up in something like this. And as you can see, there's not really much there. There is sort of a regular pattern of rippling. That's what's called deconvolution errors. But there's no particular feature. This little circle is something that's expanding with the speed of light since the gamma ray flare. So there's no features that look around that size or smaller. And here's just a zoom into the very central part. And you can actually see very faintly in this image the structure of the torus. And there are radio ripples in the torus that sort of move outwards the same, similar to the ones in the optical. The cross there is the pulsar, the X is the pulsar, and the two crosses are features that were identified as possible sites of radio emission in response to a flare by Lobanov et al. On the basis of the OBI observations, but we see nothing there. And there's also the inner knot feature identified in HST images that is very close, about 0.6 arc seconds or so from the pulsar. And that's been identified as a feature in the shock that may be the result, may be the origin of these gamma ray flares by various people. However, we found that there's pretty much nothing there, that you can barely see the pulsar here. The pulsar is a variable emission. And any radio emission due to the inner knot was quite small. And in fact, that should be nu L nu. The luminosity of that inner knot is very low compared to the spin down luminosity, 1.6 times 10 to the 11th. It's a much lower efficiency than it is, like many orders of magnitude lower than it is in the optical. So whatever process is going on, that knot has a steep cutoff at the low frequency end. Now, we also looked at much longer timescale differences. So this is again a difference image, subtracting one image of the Crab from the other, this time over about 11 years. And you can see there's the deconvolution errors are much smaller here because the scale is considerably larger, or rather, the true differences are larger, so you don't see the deconvolution errors as much. There's a quite distinct pattern of ripples and stuff, and you can clearly see sort of stuff associated with the torus. This has been known for some time, that especially in the central region here, that there's ripples that propagate outwards in the radio emission as well as in the optical emission. The fact that these ripples sort of fade out as you go outwards suggests either the amplitude is lower or the time scales are longer as you move outwards. These changes are quite large. They can be up to about 10% of the peak brightness in the nebula, so the whole thing is wobbling around by a significant amount. And this pattern is actually consistent with, I suspect we'll hear more of this in a talk later today by Almi, with the MHD modeling of the nebula. And they found that the radio morphology actually reflects just the flow pattern of the relativistic fluid. It doesn't matter that much where the electrons are accelerated, and you get these instabilities that sort of propagate outwards, and then they bounce off the Rayleigh-Taylor filaments, and you get sort of this complicated structure. Now, what I didn't say with that earlier difference image was that before I made the difference image, I subtracted out the expansion. If you just blink the two images, these have been high-pass filtered of the Crab Nebula at these two times. Then you get this. You can pretty clearly see that it's expanding. This is not really great news. We've known it's been expanding. But what I wanted to do was accurately measure how fast it's expanding. In this image, there's not, unlike the optical, where there's fairly well-defined knots, there's not really that much by way of features that you can pick and just measure the proper motion of a single feature. So what I did was a program called MDIF, first suggested, I think, by Tan and Gull. Basically, you just make one image look like the other by least squares, and you calculate the scaling that you need to do that, and that gives you the expansion rate. We also sort of fit basically nuisance parameters in this case, a brightness scaling and a brightness offset, and an XY translation. And I used this whole, I observed the crab for my thesis many, many moons ago, so we have images over about 30 years, and we picked images made with only the B array, or I think in some cases filtered so that we have a particular range of spatial frequencies, so to get the most consistent sort of match of images from these different times. And as I said, the thing that we're fitting for between each pair of images is the expansion ratio. How much do you have to make this image bigger to make it look like that image? And the values we got were 1.07 over those 5 years and 1.04 over the longer period of time. Now, if you translate those expansion ratios into expansion speed in percent per year, this is what you get. So here's the expansion rate in percent per year. It's about 0.13. This purple line is the average. And they hang nicely together. There's a very slight suggestion that the expansion rate is actually increasing with time, but given the size of the uncertainties, that's not a very definite conclusion. This corresponds to at the outside edge of the nebula, so at about 3 arcminutes from the center, this corresponds to about 2,300 kilometers a second. Now, that's the expansion rate of the synchrotron bubble as seen in the radio, and there's a long history of looking at the expansion of the optical filaments. This is from a paper by Nugent, who was the last in a line of several people, including Virginia Trimble and Bade, who played this game in the past. And he identified these filaments and measured the proper motion. You extrapolate the proper motion backwards in time, and the time when the filaments are all closest together gives you the convergent state. That method is actually slightly biased, and it gives you a convergence state that's a little too close to the present, and this simulation will show you how, if you take a set of filaments, filament positions and proper motions, now let's assume that the nebula is completely static, so the true proper motions are zero, but the measured proper motions, of course, are non-zero because you have errors, and take this set of filaments and proper motions and just let it evolve in time. So here's such a set that this is, I exaggerated the motions a bit so that you could see it, but this is what happens at minus 400 years. Now watch what happens as you let this evolve. And at the present time, they're closest together, even though the proper motions are completely random. And so if you looked at this, you'd say the convergence state is the present, even though the true convergence state is infinitely far in the past or infinitely far in the future. Basically, that's the noise bias that happens with calculating the convergence state. You get a value that's a little too close to the present. So I did a Bayesian approach to try and do a better calculation of the convergence state, and we assume starting values. You assume a set of true velocities. Once you've assumed for each filament, once you've assumed those determine the present velocities and positions. And then you just compare those hypothetical present velocities and positions to the measured positions and the measured proper motions or velocities. And by comparing them, you can calculate the probability of this particular set of hypothesized values. You can integrate over all possible hypothesized values the one we're interested in is mostly the convergence state, but also the true filament motions, and get a probability distribution. And so here's, this is the true filament positions in the present time, and the green dots are the Bayesian estimates of the true positions and velocities. And at the moment, you can more or less only see the green dots because they're where the highest probability is where the filaments really are today. And the blue dots are the measured values. And as you propagate them backwards in time, they all converge. But what happens, the blue circle shows the RMS circle of if you just propagate the measured velocities backwards. And when it goes red, this is the minimum of the measured ones, but you can see the Bayesian ones continue to actually collapse, and the convergence time is a little earlier in time. So basically, we get a slightly earlier convergence date. We get AD 1091 plus or minus 34. But it's actually not a whole lot after 1054. Aren't very sensitive to the choice of prior distribution. And it's notably later than the 1130 plus or minus 16. You notice also that our uncertainty is rather higher. That's because this uncertainty does not include the contribution from the actually uncertain proper motion measurements. This uncertainty is just based on the scatter at the convergence time. Now, so the optical filament convergence rate is 1091. The radio synchrotron convergence rate, if you take that expansion rate of 0.134 or so percent per year, is considerably later, and the difference here is quite significant. So basically the conclusion is that the radio synchrotron bubble is expanding faster than the optical filaments. If we assume a power law expansion for the radio synchrotron bubble, you get that it's expanding with time to the 1.26. This is pretty much in the range that various people, Roger Chevalier and Bucantini and all the people have done simulations, both analytical and numerical, and that they get that a pulsar wind bubble inside freely expanding ejecta expands with values something like this. For the filaments, M is considerably lower. So the filaments, as Roger said in his talk at the start of the conference, are thought to be the Rayleigh-Taylor instability at the edge of the pulsar wind bubble. And you expect that the pulsar wind bubble will therefore sort of expand out through the filaments, and that's pretty much exactly what we see. Okay, I left off the end of that sentence. What these measurements aren't compatible with is the case of a paracollapsed supernova where the pulsar wind bubble is expanding into the stellar wind, because in that case, the pulsar wind bubble wouldn't be accelerated. And I will stop there. That's me, mom and dad, hiking in the Swiss Alps against the Crab Nebula. And does anyone have any questions?
Thanks, Michael. Do we have questions? Ron?
The northern jet of the Crab,
yep.
Which is the least accelerated by the synchrotron, gives you a date around 1055 plus or minus 25 years. That was published a few years ago.
Yes.
So the Crab did occur in 1054. And so... that's it.
I didn't actually figure out whether it's possible that those measurements are less biased by this, because the ratio of error to expansion velocity is probably lower.
Yeah.
So it may just be that that's the same expansion age as the filaments have if you do it properly.
Right. All right.
Reno?
So... what is shown in basically says that the acceleration of the filaments along the equatorial plane is higher than the acceleration along the poles. That was something that could have been already inferred from the old Trimbos data. So I think it's in a sense reasonable, in the sense that near the equatorial plane you have magnetic fields which are more tangential than near the poles, so probably in an acceleration of the filament would be more efficient. Could you comment about that?
I didn't try that. I mean, that expansion model has the expansion velocity just being set by the position of the filament, basically, so completely circularly symmetric, and that works pretty well. So my guess is that we don't have the signal noise to determine whether it's expanding faster in this direction than in this direction. Yeah. Sorry.
Steve.
So do you have a significant value for the flux change over the period that you've been monitoring the morphology?
No, because these observations were B array only, so we don't recover the whole structure. So the larger scale structure in the image actually came from earlier observations, so I can't really say anything about the flux change.
Any remaining questions? Okay, well then let's thank Michael and all the speakers from this morning.